When we began our journey through Habakkuk last week, we joined in with the prophet Habakkuk, and we looked at his world, and he invited us to look at our world, and we saw that our two worlds had a lot in common. It's depressing when we read the paper. We can be discouraged by the things that are happening in our own homes, in our neighborhoods, in our own hearts. We leave our look at the evidence on display around us, and we ask, where is God? And when we join Habakkuk, we come to the realization that this is happening because of what is going on inside the people of God, not because of these evil, uncontrolled things that make us feel like innocent victims. In Habakkuk's story, what we looked at was not external opposition. And so we ask, where is God? And we ask, how long, oh Lord? How long, oh Lord? Now, last week, we looked at the question that Habakkuk asked. And this week, we're going to back up a little bit. We did some background where we saw how some of this injustice that was on display here was happening in his day and how they'd gotten to that point. And then from that context, Habakkuk asks a question. So we're going to revisit that question, and then we're going to look at the answer that God gives. So with that in mind, let's hear God's word. Habakkuk chapter 1, I'm beginning in verse 2 and reading through verse 11. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen, or cry out to you, violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife, and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed. For I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture, swooping to devour. They all come bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They deride kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all the fortified cities. They build earthen ramps and capture them. They sweep past like the wind and go on. Guilty men, whose own strength is their God. So Habakkuk asks a question, and he gets an answer. It's not the answer he wanted, but he gets an answer. So let's look at how those things work together. The question or the complaint that comes from Habakkuk's lips are found in verses 2 through 4. He said, "How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen, God? Or I cry to you violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed, and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous, so that justice is perverted." He's shouting, things are a mess. Things are not the way they're supposed to be. How long, O Lord, must I cry out? Destruction and violence, strife and conflict. The law is paralyzed. Justice never prevails. And he declares, as I try to stand here in righteousness, I am hemmed in so that justice is perverted. Habakkuk is in distress. But he's in distress based upon what he is really seeing. I mean, in his complaint or question, he says, why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you put all of this mess before me? And he's declaring, Father, God, the Mighty One, you have enough power to prevent this. Why are you not doing something about this? It's real easy for us to, man, this Habakkuk's negative. He's kind of a whiny snot. And he would be a whiny little snot if he were reinterpreting what was going on around him, making it sound like this mess that really wasn't. And we do that sometimes, don't we? Reinterpret things to kind of try to get God off the hook. But Habakkuk is being completely honest. As a matter of fact, last week we looked and we saw that there are some things that we can affirm in this question that he's asking. There are some things that we can say are good steps, even in the complaint that he puts forward. So if we look through those, we'll see that he is praying, and not only that, but he is praying honestly. This honest prayer of his comes from a deep belief that God could do something about this current situation. That comes from a deep belief that God is in control. And all over this complaint, we see the deep belief that the way things are, this wrong way, this way that things aren't supposed to be, but the way that things are in deep conflict with God's character. So there's a lot that we can affirm in this question that Habakkuk asks. And when we read it, I think we get grabbed with the tension of how is God going to respond to this? Because God's receiving this complaint, and God could say, how dare you? How dare you talk to me like that? So that sounds painfully familiar to the way that this dad responds to complaints. How dare you? What we see, though, from the text is that God does not say, how dare you? God does not even say, I choose to remain silent. God says, I'm glad you asked. I'm glad you asked because I have an answer. And so for a moment, when we hear that, we brighten. Good. Finally. God's going to do something. There's excitement. There's excitement even in the beginning of the answer. Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed, for I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe even if I told you. You hear the anticipation? My emotion runs into that thinking, this is going to be wonderful. This is going to be fantastic. God says, I'm glad you asked. Let me tell you, because it's going to amaze you. But we see that his response is shocking. His answer is shocking. It definitely falls in the category of glad you asked. There's not a hint of how dare you in the answer, but it's shocking nonetheless. Let's listen to the answer. I'm going to read it again. You might not have realized that God was speaking the answer at this point in the passage, but he is. Habakkuk has made his complaint that we've just looked at, his complaint that came in the form of a prayer that in lots of ways was an exemplary prayer. And then beginning in verse 5, God answers. And so let's listen carefully to God's answer. God's answer. Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe. You would not believe even if you were told. And so that sets the stage. And then God explains, I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. God declares, I'm doing this. I'm raising them up. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture sweeping to devour. They all come bent on violence. Their horses advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They deride kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities. They build earthen ramps and capture those cities. Capture them. It's talking about those cities. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on. Guilty men whose own strength is their God. That's the answer. That's the answer. Look and be amazed. God says, get ready. You're not going to believe this. When we first read, we're not going to believe this, it's like something's going to happen that was just beyond our imagination. And it is. But then God takes a step back. And he says, not only is it something you couldn't have thought up yourself, it's something that when I tell you, when someone tells you, you still won't believe it. It's really unbelievable. And you just imagine the way that Habakkuk is listening to this, thinking, all right, good, finally. I've had enough of this. I'm ready for something beyond my imagination that I can't believe. And God says, I am raising up the Babylonians. Who? The Babylonians. You can't mean those Babylonians. Yes, those Babylonians. Let me describe them for you and tell you who they are, God says. This is what they are like. This is what they do. They are ruthless and rash. They sweep and they seize. They are a law unto themselves. I'm raising them up. Those ones that sweep across the earth, seizing places that are not their own. They are feared and dreaded, we see in verse 7. God explains. They're a law to themselves, and they promote their own honor. You see, nobody else from outside has to prop them up and make them look impressive. They're not obedient to anything apart from what originates within them. They are a law unto themselves. Let me tell you about their horses as the description continues. Their horses are impressive. This is what their horses are like. Their horses are swifter than leopards. This is amazing. They have horses that are fast. And these fast horses aren't just fast horses. They are fierce horses. If you want to know how fierce these horses are, imagine what a wolf is like in the evening at dusk. That's what these fierce horses are like. So let me describe them a little further. These horses fly like vultures. It's as though they have wings. They swoop down just like a vulture to devour. Now you see, at our house, we feed wild birds. Most people feed wild birds birdseed. We feed wild birds chickens. And that sounds funny, but there's lots of hawks around here to get rid of too many rabbits and too many squirrels and apparently too many chickens, because the hawks love our chickens. I don't like the hawks when they're liking my chickens, which is amazing because I used to drive down the road and love hawks. I would slow down to watch a hawk work. But I don't have to do that anymore, because I can watch the hawk work in my backyard as he attacks my chickens. So we keep our chickens pinned up so the hawk can't get to them. And one day the hawk decided to test our cage. And he put on, I don't know how many minutes of a show, where he swooped and came and scared the chickens, and by golly, he tested every corner of that coop to see if there was a way that he could get to those chickens. Nobody felt sorry for the hawk. The hawk was equipped to swoop down and to devour. And you know what? That's exactly the way that God chooses to describe the Babylonians and this thing that he's going to do that we're not going to believe even once he's told us. In verse 9, we learn more about them. They are bent on violence. That violence is described as a desert wind that gathers up prisoners, the same way that a desert windstorm gathers up sand. And you know how much that is? That's more than you can count. It's more than you can count. And as we read this, we have to remember that in the fullness of time, everything God said is what happened. They mock kings and rulers. They deride kings, they scoff at rulers. They mock them. And the kings and rulers who have spent their resources to fortify and defend their cities produce cities that just get laughed at. Because they take strategic action to gain victory even over these kinds of cities. They build earthen ramps and capture them. Which, you know, doesn't sound that all impressive when you've seen a caterpillar bulldozer do such a thing. But then you step back and say, wait, they don't have a caterpillar bulldozer. And they are moving earth to overcome a fortified city. And it kind of makes me shudder. Oh my. How do they do this? And how terrifying is that? When people that don't have a bulldozer can act as though they have a bulldozer, that's some powerful people. In summary, the description says they sweep past like wind. And as that wind goes on, it goes forward as guilty men. Guilty men. Whose own strength is their God. Their own strength is their God. If you look, you'll notice the little g for God. So when God is speaking, he's not saying their strength is me. He's making it clear. No, it's a God. It is the thing that they worship. They worship their own strength. That's what they worship. That means they look to their strength for life. They look to their strength for salvation. Their strength, the object of their worship, is their idol. The thing they trust. The thing that occupies the space that only God has. And that's where God's answer ends. So the conversation goes, to recap, God, what are you going to do about this? I can't believe you haven't done anything yet. And God says, I'm glad you asked. Let me tell you what you're not going to believe what I'm going to do. You can't even imagine what I'm going to do. I'm going to rise up a vicious nation of idolaters that are so powerful that they are going to destroy you. Gee, thanks. Wow. What an answer. What an answer. Is this a satisfactory answer? This was not the answer that the prophet ever imagined or desired. This is an answer that calls forth another question. And that's convenient because the book's not over. So another question will come. But as we dwell here in this question, and we dwell in this answer, we see that justice is asked for, and God will do it. He'll bring this justice through the violent and the proud nation of Babylon. And your Bible might say the Chaldeans, and that's another name for Babylon. That is a perplexing response. That is a confounding answer to a question. It is a response that challenges Habakkuk's faith. And you know what? It challenges our faith as well. Today, it challenges our faith. The truth that God can bring about good from evil is a theme that echoes throughout the whole Bible. Now, if we were looking for an example of this, there are so many, but we can find one in Genesis chapter 50, verse 20. And this declaration is found on the lips of Joseph, the sons of Jacob, Joseph. And this is what he said to his brothers. He said, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." That's one of so many places where God does this. God uses evil, and while the evil remains evil, God accomplishes good things. God accomplishes amazing things. God accomplishes things that we would not believe, even if we were told them. If we glance back at Joseph's story and the context where this statement comes from, out of jealousy, his brothers go out to kill Joseph, and then they realize, wait a second, if we kill him, we'll be guilty, and we have a chance to turn our jealousy into some cash. So they sell him into slavery, and he's taken away, and they go back to Daddy and say, "We're sorry he's dead. Is this his coat? This coat that's been driving us crazy because we're so jealous of it, is this his coat?" And it's covered with the blood of animals, and they say, "One of those ravenous wolves at dusk must have got hold of your son Joseph. Sorry, Dad. He's gone." And our jealousy's taken care of. And so, I would say that qualifies as evil. And as the story continues, that going into slavery results in prison for the innocent Joseph. And through that time in prison, God provides deliverance for his people. Joseph is able to see with the clarity that he can say, "Brothers, what you intended for evil, God has used for good. As a matter of fact, God used it for their very salvation," because they would have starved to death if Joseph, because of their evil, had not been put in the place where he could be used by God for their deliverance. So the evil remains evil, but God accomplishes good. So hard to understand that. Hard for me to wrap my mind around that truth. But maybe it's a little bit like modern medicine. You see, we can get a category of disease that none of us wants to talk about called cancer. And now that'll make all of us shudder, because we've all been touched in some way within our friends and family and loved ones by cancer. We know about cancer. Now, this interesting thing happens. This doctor that is supposed to take care of you and help you heal, he says, "You seem to have cancer." I have an idea. I'll give you poison. Now, we call that poison chemotherapy. And, man, if you didn't shudder with cancer, you shuddered at chemotherapy. I was reluctant to even use that because I just don't even want to make people that have been through that have to think about it. And you know why we don't want to think about it? Because it's poison. In any other category, they would put that doctor in jail. Because doctors aren't supposed to poison people. It's kind of the opposite of what's supposed to happen. But the doctor says, let's take this evil, let's take this poison and put it to work. And sometimes we can rejoice because healing occurs as that poison kills the things that need to be killed. That stuff we call cancer. And then the body's able to recuperate from the poison and go forward healthy. So the poison is useful. But you know what? The poison never stops being poison. It is poison. Poison is an evil thing that will destroy you. Unless it's being used by a very skilled hand where it has the chance of making you well. That's a little bit what this situation is like. I'm going to get to the other, to next week's question. I'll give you a little foreshadow. Habakkuk's going to say, but Babylonians are evil. How can you make them good while they remain evil? And God's going to say, I didn't say I was making them good. God says, I'm going to hold them accountable for the evil they do. See, when the doctor uses poison, chemotherapy, it doesn't stop being poison. And at the end of the treatment, it goes back on the shelf, and you know what it still is? It's still poison. God doesn't make the poison cease to be poison even while he uses it to accomplish good. Sometimes to accomplish something very good beyond what we can imagine. So good, we wouldn't even believe it if somebody told us. As we think about that and as we listen to God's answer, we are invited to look at the cross. And, you know, sometimes I say we can look at the cross and it's like, maybe I do this sometimes, I try not to, but maybe some preachers do this amazing Pele kick. Now, you got to be a certain age to know who Pele is. But Pele was Cristiano Ronaldo. If you know who Pele is, you probably don't know who that is. But these amazing soccer players, and Pele was famous for his windmill kick, where he took a pass and flipped upside down, and while his foot was up in the air, he kicked the ball into the goal. And it was amazing that he was able to do that. I don't think he did it in games very often. But it was amazing that he could do that. Now, occasionally, the task of preaching a sermon makes me feel like, well, I've got to get to the cross in a passage that's just this really bad news. So how am I going to do that? Am I going to do a Pele kick? Well, I don't have to. Because, and it's a good thing, because Paul chooses to use our very passage, the passage we're looking at today, when he was explaining the gospel. He's given a sermon in Acts 13, and after he has explained what Jesus has done on the cross, he says this, Acts 13, chapter 40. Beware, therefore, lest what is said in the prophets should come about. And then he quotes from our passage, kind of. He says, look, you scoffers, and be astounded and perish, for I am doing a work in your days, a work that you will not believe, even if one tells it to you. Now, he's quoting from Habakkuk, and he's deploying it a little bit differently. And it almost sounds like he's saying something else, but there's the flexibility in the meaning of the words that both what we read, that's a very good translation from the Old Testament, and this that sounds a little different is still a very good translation. So in the context of him telling about the cross, he leans on God's answer to Habakkuk. And he says, this time it's a warning. It came to Habakkuk as a promise in response to a question. Here, it's a warning to those who hear what God has done on the cross, what's been done by God on the cross. So as we think about that, wow, I just crunched ice on a microphone. I am so sorry. That gave me shudders. I want you to imagine with me a conversation that never happened. We could have imagined this conversation with lots of people. Now, Joseph would have actually been a pretty good candidate for this conversation that never happened. Moses would have been a very good candidate for this conversation that never happened. But for this conversation that never happened, let's think about David. And through the fall, we looked at the story of David as it appears in the book of 1 Samuel. So if you worship here regularly, you kind of know that story. If you're a guest, you can look that up. But that's why I decided to park on David. And David had lots of opportunity to ask the same kind of question that Habakkuk was asking. David could say, God, you have called me, and you have given me the opportunity to try to serve this man Saul that's become the king, and you've promised me that I'm going to be king, and that doesn't exactly make sense, but this man is trying to kill me. And this isn't what I thought it meant to be the king, and this sure feels like evil, and how long, O Lord? What are you up to? Or if we move forward in David's life, David could be talking to God about his family. These sons that you've given me, they're scoundrels. In my own household, there's things I can't understand. I'm being hunted by my son Absalom. He's trying to kill me. How long, O Lord? Or maybe David looks into his own heart and he remembers the sin that he committed with his officer's wife, that resulted in adultery, in murder, in the death of the son that was a product of that adultery. And so David looks into his own heart and says, this is not the way it's supposed to be. How long, O Lord? This is a conversation that never actually happened. But if we think about the way that God answered Habakkuk, the conversation that never happened, but that would have been completely true if the conversation ever happened, would have gone something like this. God could say, David, look at what I'm going to do. You won't believe this. As a matter of fact, you wouldn't believe this if I told you. This is what I'm going to do. I am going to raise up a nation, a mighty political military force. By the way, Babylon couldn't even stood up against this force. And I'm going to name it Rome. And they are going to be powerful. They're going to be powerful like nobody's ever seen powerful. And they're going to be brutal. And in the conversation that never happened, that's based on totally true things, David would have responded with, "That sounds crazy. I don't see how that could be a benefit to any of these problems. This nation, this family, this heart of mine, I don't see it." And God could say in the conversation that never actually happened, yeah, they will be powerful and they will be brutal. As a matter of fact, they're going to be so novel, they're going to be so inventive in their brutality, that they are going to invent this unbelievable thing called crucifixion. This thing that's so terrible that if you're a citizen of this nation, they won't use it on you. But if you're a non-citizen, enemy of this nation, do they have the way to get your attention? This amazing innovation called crucifixion. And then God would say to David in this conversation that would have been true but never actually happened, "Through it, I will save you, David." And David might say, "Well, how are you going to do that?" And God might say, "Well, you know, I've promised you a son that will sit on the throne forever." "Yeah, he's my son too. It's confusing, David. You'll explain it when we get to heaven and I can explain it to you. But this one son is going to die in this brutal execution invented by this brutal nation. And through that is going to be salvation. And David, because of that, it's going to be salvation for your nation. It's going to be salvation for your family. It's going to be salvation for your sinful, rebellious heart. For your soul. For your whole being." Because you see, in that crucifixion on that cross, God is going to, he would say in the conversation that never happened, but we'll leave that conversation and instead we'll look back on what really happened. And what God declares he did was he satisfied his justice so that every evil thing that was breaking Habakkuk's heart that made him make his complaint and everything else, and every evil thing that occurred in David's heart and in my heart and in your heart were paid for. And God's justice was completely satisfied on that cross. And then God went beyond what we could believe or imagine. He said, not only that, but as he makes that payment and takes that sin, he is going to give you his righteousness, the very righteousness of God, because he's my son, and he has my righteousness because he is God, even as I am God. He's going to give it to you. And David would say, "I can't imagine that. I'm not sure I can even understand that if I were told that." And yet that is the truth. So when we look at Habakkuk, we see a little picture of the way that God accomplishes his justice. And it's a little picture because it becomes a picture of that cross. See, Paul declares it to be so. That's why he used it when he was talking about the cross. He was talking about this thing you're not going to believe that's going to happen. It's a promise, and it's a warning. It's the story of the whole Bible. As you heard me mention, next week we'll look at logical questions that flow out of this question that seems so unsatisfactory here in chapter 1. But it is the story of the whole Bible. And you know what? It's your story. And it really is. It really is your story. Every person in this room, it's your story. The question is, will you receive it? Because it's your story whether you receive it or not. And man, that is a that's a painful phrase. Let me say it again. It's your story whether you receive it or not. Because if we receive it, the promise is life. The promise is forgiveness. The promise is righteousness. The very righteousness of God. If we receive it, it's yours. But if we don't receive it, then judgment awaits. The judgment that is horrible and appropriate because of that very cross. So you see, that story is your story. How long, O Lord, why do you tolerate wrong? God gives an answer. An answer that calls more questions from our hearts. More questions that focus us on the story of the cross and remind us that's our story.